I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Friday, March 10th, 2023. The time is 3:31 p.m. Committee members present, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Clayman, Senator Kaufman, Senator Wilkowski, who's vice chair, and on teleconference should be Senator Dunbar. I'm not seeing him right now, but I know he intended to, and myself, co-chair, Senator Giesel. Excuse today.
I'm here, Madam Chair.
You're here? Oh, great. Thank you, Senator Dunbar. Thank you for being present. Senator Bishop is excused. Thank you to Carrie Cooper Ryder and Amanda Kraft for making this meeting possible. And today we're going to go through Senate Bill 49, carbon storage. So we've gone through a lot of informational meetings on the industry, the geologic issues, and today we're going to hear actually the presentation of the bill as proposed. Let's see who's online. I thought, Commissioner Boyle is not online yet, unless I'm missing him. But here in the room we have Deputy Commissioner John Crowther, and Haley Payne, Deputy Director of the Division of Oil and Gas, and Brett Huber, who is the Chair of Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, is online. So, also online is Anthony Strupolis, who is the State Pipeline Coordinator, Division of Oil and Gas, Dr. David LePayne, State Geologist, and Aaron O'Quinn, Leasing Section Manager, Division of Oil and Gas. So, lots of lifelines. Oh, and there's the commissioner, also online. Great. Well, D.C. Crowther, I will let you take it away.
Thank you, Chair Giesel and members of the committee. I believe the commissioner would like to do a brief introduction.
That's great. Commissioner Boyle?
Yeah, good afternoon, Madam Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. For the record, this is John Boyle, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Natural Resources, and I appreciate the committee's willingness to allow me to testify or at least deliver these introductory remarks telephonically. I returned very early this morning from Sarah Week in Houston, and so I'm just playing a little bit of catch-up here, but I actually really wanted to give the introductory remarks based on sort of the experience that I recently had at CERAWeek. And I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to talk to a number of not only some of the largest oil and gas, companies operating in Alaska or, in the United States or even the world for that matter, but also a number of different, private equity groups, financiers, infrastructure investment firms, so on and so forth. And there was an incredible amount of excitement about Alaska and particularly about our initiative to create a statutory framework that would enable carbon capture, utilization, and storage projects. Hydrogen development is something that is seen as critical to assisting in what's sort of being billeted now as the energy transformation. And, a key component to those activities, of course, is being able to manage the CO2 output in those industrial, processes. And so really what we're looking at with SB 49 is, again, that broad framework that would allow the state, of course, to put together a program to allow for the leasing and the injection and regulation of carbon dioxide into underground reservoirs. And so there's, an incredible amount of interest from the broader investment community, as there also is with industry, that sees a number of opportunities to really capitalize on these 45Q tax credits that are within the Internal Revenue Service tax code, to help incentivize a lot of activities that would enable them not only to explore, new enhanced oil recovery methods utilizing carbon dioxide, but also to enable them to meet the, very stringent environmental benchmarks of net zero that many of these companies have outlined as a result of, you know, pressure from their shareholders or their boards. And so, you know, we really see this as a critical need for the state to address. We think that by having this program in place, that we will open the state up to additional investment, and that, you know, as time moves forward and we see other, you know, other resource development opportunities progress, whether that be AKLNG, whether that be the development of geothermal resources, so on and so forth, that having this framework that enables carbon capture, utilization, storage to take place will really put the state at a competitive advantage and in a prime position to attract capital, because there's a lot of money out there looking for infrastructure projects, but so much of that money or that capital is predicated on not only building infrastructure projects, but infrastructure projects that also, you know, fit in with, you know, companies or, you know, these firms' goals to make sure that it's done in an environmentally responsible manner, you know, vis-a-vis managing atmospheric, you know, releases of carbon. So, you know, really we're really excited to bring this bill forward. You know, I think as you'll hear from the experts that can talk about Alaska's strategic advantage when it comes to our ownership of, you know, broad swaths of state land and the underlying mineral estate that, you know, makes it very simple for a company to come up and have a good understanding of not only the types of, you know, the geology and the, you know, amount of carbon storage area that's available, but also to have that ability to, you know, have a one-stop shop in terms of just being able to deal with one entity, the state, instead of having to deal with myriad different landowners and interest owners, as they often do, as they, you know, work on developing some of these projects in the lower 48 or, you know, even in other countries. So we really have an incredible opportunity here to capitalize on that. And we also have some, you know, again, some very exciting opportunities, I think, with this when it comes to, for instance, some of our coal-fired generation and the ability to sequester carbon in, you know, deep seams of unmineable coal. You know, you'll hear a lot in our presentations. We're thinking of areas like the Cook Inlet or the North Slope that are, you know, have, you know, depleted reservoir space that would be, you know, really well suited for carbon storage. But, you know, we also have a number of areas in interior Alaska as well that could be very attractive for carbon capture projects that, you know, again, could lengthen the life of, you know, coal-fired plants, that could, you know, provide more opportunities for, you know, businesses and entities involved with mining coal. And so we, you know, again, we see this as a way to really help enhance opportunities, not only for, you know, potential new investors with energy projects in the state, but also for a number of our existing producers and companies that are also interested in lowering the carbon intensity of their operations. So, you know, we really appreciate the committee's, you know, willingness to, you know, move forward and looking at this. You know, we're excited to kind of engage with you in a conversation around how we can best implement this to fit the state's purposes. You know, one of the things that I really like in particular about CCUS is that because the state's underground pore space is considered to be a mineral asset of the state, you know, a significant portion, 25% of the revenues that we could expect to collect from this activity, you know, would then be deposited into a permanent fund. And so, you know, the opportunity of growing our permanent fund through a non kind of traditional revenue source, monetizing a state resource that heretofore has had no monetary value, to me is just something that's very exciting and, you know, fills me with a lot of hope and optimism for what we can, you know, expect to accomplish, you know, as we move into the future. And, you know, just to sort of address one issue that I know has lingered about, you know, it will obviously take some time for us, not only for AOGCC to be able to get primacy from the EPA on you know, regulating Class VI wells, and also for us to kind of set up the regulatory framework, as well as, you know, for some of these projects to move forward to a state to where, you know, carbon capture, utilization, and storage might make sense. It's important that we get the process started now and get the framework in place so that, you know, a few years down the line, when these opportunities really become much more ripe, that we're ready to sort of take advantage of those. And, you know, we're trying to be very circumspect in terms of the kind of revenues we think that this particular, you know, bill would generate over time. I think, you know, again, it's going to take some time for us to actually see, you know, what materializes. But we have a very high level of confidence that the state has a lot of upside in terms of being able to monetize our underground pore space. And given, you know, the relatively modest expenditures to get this program up and running, we really do believe that it's in the state's best interest to pursue this. And again, we really look forward to, you know, working with the committee and bringing in, you know, the relevant experts that can really help inform, you know, all of our decision making as we look to think through how we want to structure this program. So with that, I really appreciate the committee's time, and unless there's any specific questions for me, I'm happy to hand it over to my team that can walk us through the elements of the bill.
Thank you, Commissioner. I don't see any questions. Thank you for that introduction. So I'll turn it over to you, Mr. Crowder.
Thank you, Chair, and I will turn it over to my colleague, Haley Payne.
Thank you for that introduction. For the record, my name is Haley Payne. I am the Deputy Director at the Division of Oil and Gas. And again, just to echo the statements made, thank you for the time this Friday afternoon, and also for all the time the committee has already put in this week trying to get experts in front of you to really form the background so that we can handle this walkthrough appropriately. So just to go ahead and get started, I wanted to give an outline for the presentation today. We'll do a very brief introduction, just the basic of CCUS. Again, not spending too much time on this as we've spent some time already on it this week. And then we'd really like to transition into a CCUS project overview. And so actually taking a look at what are those phases of a project, you know, from the exploration all the way into injection and post-closure, and then looking at how those timing elements fit in to actually reach those points of injection. And then finally, where in our bill are we addressing those various phases of the exploration and the process itself? After that section, we'll talk a little bit about the funding collection and revenue. Really big theme that'll be in this section and again throughout the bill presentation is this sort of bifurcation between the role of the state as the regulator and also the one as the sovereign. And so when we're thinking about funding, we're thinking about how we cover our funding in terms of the regulatory program, and then where do we generate the revenues that go into our general and permanent fund. After that is just a high-level sectional summary. Although there are several sections to this bill, many of them are what we call like conforming amendments, so we'll be able to move through those pretty quickly. We will spend quite a bit of time, though, on sections 14 and 31, which have kind of the heavy lift of the bill itself. So just to start with, anytime you're in legislative development, you want to look at your lodestone. And so for us, of course, that is the Alaska Constitution. At DNR and at AOGCC, Department of Natural Resources and Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, we're really kind of driven a lot by Article 8. And so in here we read that it's the policy of the state to encourage the settlement of its lands and the development of its resources by making them available for the maximum use consistent with the public interest. And then further to this point, the legislature may provide for the leasing of and issuance of permits and exploration for any part of the public domain or interest subject to reasonable concurrent uses. And so how does SB 49 stay true to this constitutional directive? Well, first of all, it's going to enable the state to maximize the use of its pore space, resource consistent with the public interest. As Commissioner Boyle was just articulating, our pore space, or those little microscopic holes in between grains of sand where you would inject the CO2, up to this point hasn't really been monetized. So this represents an opportunity to open up a whole new resource to monetization. This bill also seeks to provide for reasonable concurrent uses and protection of all parties. We'll hit highlights on those portions within the AOGCC and DNR sections that really sort of recognize those existing rights of other lessees, mineral and property interest owners, and how do we address that while still maximizing that concurrent use for the state. And then finally, what I think is important to note here is that this is going to empower DNR and AOGCC to utilize existing authorities and expertise on carbon dioxide storage. So we're not creating a whole new suite of authorities that are not already invested in DNR and AOGCC. This is all based on the experience we've had with oil and gas, exploration, gas storage, and even geothermal. And so we're just getting to apply that to a whole new sort of product, if you will. This is a diagram that I believe is familiar to the committee. It's been referenced before, but just to remind folks, so what is CCUS, carbon capture, utilization, and storage? It's the term of art for basically everything from capturing CO2 from point source emissions or direct air capture, compressing that down and then transporting that via pipeline or via ship, and then handling it off for beneficial uses or for actual geologic storage. As Dr. LaPaine articulated in much better detail than I could hope to go into, when we're looking at geologic storage, we're talking about injecting CO2 deep underground. And so that's strata that's going to be at least 2,400 feet below surface. In particular, the type of reservoirs that we're targeting are going to be depleted oil and gas reservoirs, saline aquifers, and even unmineable coal seams are showing to be very promising for this particular technology.
Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question has to do with something that you said and something that the commissioner had said earlier about having the available space. I recognize that we do have quite a bit because we have a history of gas cycling up in North Slope, but how do we know that we have enough space either in these saline aquifers or in coal seams or in just general seals?
Sure.
Because we haven't really, I mean, we always talk about how we don't really know what we don't have because we haven't really done a lot in Alaska comparatively.
Mm-hmm. Well, Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, just broadly speaking, from an oil and gas context, we're able to do predictions and engineering calculations based on what the original oil or original gas would be in place. And so we're able to tell that through, various well data and pressure logs and determine how much gas that container would have held, and then also extrapolate further what size of container must that have been in order to hold that particular amount. And so that is what sort of gives us that ability to begin to put forward what some of those potentials are. We know how much we've taken out, and so then therefore how much must be left within that space. To your point, when we're looking at saline aquifers or unmineable coal seams, true, we have not spent much time yet sort of assessing those resources. But from what we've learned from other jurisdictions, it's in fact saline aquifers do tend to be larger and even more expansive than oil and gas reservoirs and have been shown in other locations to have even greater potential than those. But that necessarily would require further study and analysis in a site-specific way.
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, just to supplement, very well said by my colleague Haley. I would just note, I'm not a geologist myself, but my understanding is that some places don't have the geology to really even have these formations at scale. And in the formation or the structure needed to perform this, to have traps and seals, to have sandstones that are, capped in an appropriate way. But Alaska certainly has that. Obviously, our oil reserves show that there's those kind of structures that are charged with oil, but those same kind of structures are very present in Alaska. And so any project would obviously have to move through that characterization phase to confirm on a project-specific level, but we generally have the kind of geology that makes us a very prospective area for this. Very encouraging from our perspective.
Thank you. No further questions. I'll let you go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Again, for the record, this is Haley Payne. So just the last point on introduction and the why now. Again, I think Commissioner Boyle and his time at CERAWeek really encapsulate a lot of these reasons. But just a few other things that I might highlight. You know, it's really critical component to this legislation is the timing of it. We're not the first state to do this, but fortunately, we're still within a window that we may capitalize on these opportunities that are now present. In particular, you have the 45Q tax credits here in the U.S. However, at an international level, you also have, you know, extensive pledges and promises by corporations and by nations that are seeking to create other mechanisms to sort of drive this forward. Maybe just to give an example of scale. Right now, there's about 35 different CCUS facilities that are in operation or construction globally. The IEA predicts that by 2070, we would need to have 2,600 of these in place in order to meet the different development scenarios for their climate goals. And so roughly 15% of the emission reductions that the IEA has factored in would come from CCUS use on a larger scale. So there's quite a bit of growth market potential in this at this time. The other thing which I might highlight, and we'll get more into detail as we go into the project phases, really has to do with the project timelines. So in order to take advantage of the 45Q tax credits, you need to have started construction before 2033. While that seems like a little ways off, as many of us know from resource development projects in general, the timelines that it takes for your site selection, for your procurement, for your development of your design and your permitting, you know, you can be looking at the low end of 5 years. And so that's really why there's sort of this drive necessitate to get this before the legislature as soon as possible.
No questions.
Great. Okay, so now I'll just turn to the sort of project phases themselves. So as we're talking about the injection of CO2 underground, what's necessarily sort of driving that is the use of an injection well. And our underground injection well program is facilitated by the EPA and is mandated out of the Safe Drinking Water Protection Act. And so the Safe Drinking Water Protection Act mandated that we ensure that the protections of our groundwater are going to be cared for, even though we're going to be injecting into the subsurface. And so to effectuate that, the EPA came up with a list of classes. And so each sort of type of injection well or fluid that you go into the subsurface is going to have different standards based upon the characteristics of that substance, the depth at which it's injected. And so up until 2010, there were only 5 classes. But in 2010, the EPA created class 6, and that's solely and exclusively for the injection of critical CO2. And so if you kind of turn to this diagram here on the left, this is something we'll start to revisit a little bit more. In that while geologic storage in the class 6 well is a primary component, as highlighted in the yellow in the graph, it's not enough just to account for the storage wells themselves when you're thinking about creating a regulatory body for CCUS. You also need to account for those portions that are outside of the well class itself. And that's really where you get into state jurisdiction. In particular, in our state, you're going to have the licensing of the mineral or the pore space that you do it in. In general, you're going to have other sort of exploratory permits, your local agencies and bodies, which are typically involved in that sort of exercise. And then beyond the exploration phase, you're going to get to this sort of end of field life, this past closure period, where you're going to have something that is going to be stored over geologic time. And so at the end of the day, the state is here. And so that's sort of what that model is based on, is that you will have a project and you will have a project end, but you will always still have this resource or the CO2 stored here on state lands. And so this is kind of continuing on, just showing that exploratory through permitting, storage, and closure, and then finally the post-closure phase. One other note on this slide, the EPA has been especially keen to have states take on primacy, which means they are the one in charge of doing the permitting for specific wells. And so primacy is especially encouraged for class 2 and class 6. So class 2 is one which AOGCC already has primacy over, and that is for oil and gas injection. And as you can see on the screen, the AOGCC is already doing this on more than 950 active injection wells. So this sort of expertise is already well within their wheelhouse, so to speak.
Madam Chair.
Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. You mentioned that the federal government likes states to contain primacy for Class 6 wells. If I know we're having sort of this current discussion right now, so what happens if the state or the legislature decides not to fund the 404 primacy?
Senator Kawasaki, through the chair, yes. If the state does not move forward with primacy, a project operator could still go through the EPA to obtain a Class 6 well permit. And indeed, in other jurisdictions, even those that are actively seeking primacy right now, you do see that folks have filed with the EPA as well as with the state in hopes that the state would complete their primacy process before the EPA has finished that permit review. But it is possible to still have it permitted through the EPA. The primary difference that we're seeing is going to be that timeline of review. North Dakota, who has primacy, is able to review a permit in about 8 months. They're targeting 6, whereas the EPA has only permitted 2 Class 6 wells up till now, and it's took over three years for them to permit those. They have about 40 individual well permits right now pending, and some of those are getting over the 2-year mark. So it really just turns into your timelines. Also of note, none of those other permits are in our EPA class region or EPA region 10, so our EPA region has yet to adjudicate one of these permits.
Thank you.
Could I just clarify, Deputy Director Payne? So Senator Kawasaki alluded to 404 primacy, and it felt like you switched to Class 6 wells. Could you clarify whether these are intertwined, that we need 404 primacy and Class 6?
Senator Giesel, John Crow, the Deputy Commissioner, for the record. So this is a separate primacy from the 404 program. That's an effort by the administration to pursue that, but it is not, one does not depend on the other. They're separate authorities that both are eligible for assumption by the state for primacy. This bill is focused on Class 6 under the UIC SDWA in Underground Injection Control Safe Drinking Water Act program.
Thank you very much for that clarification. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, to Ms. Payne. On this slide, this project stages, and then your next slide, we're starting to creep towards something that I've been wanting to see, which is like the level one master control schedule that kind of shows all the tasks that have to be done. And I guess just as we go through this, do you feel that we have good clarity of everything that has to happen and at what point it needs to happen? Because I felt like that's been a little bit of a kind of a feels a little black box, just in terms of the different, we've heard so many pieces of information, but the linear sequence that has to occur, I know we're starting to get there on the next slide, and I'm looking forward to that. But also anything that can be done separately that may not be dependent upon this particular piece of legislation, any other things that we can be doing legislatively or with current authorization. I'd like to just hear a little bit more about that as we start to get into, the kind of the timeline that we have here. Hopefully, at some point, an even more detailed schedule that will really show what needs to happen. Thank you,
Senator Kaufman. I'm going to have Deputy Director Payne wait till she gets to that slide. Right now, we're on this slide, so I'll see if there's any further questions related to this topic. Senator Klayman.
If you could, one of you could give a broad look at what is in a Class 6 well and a Class 5, 4. I mean, I assume if it's Class 6, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, but can you give us I don't want a long answer, but just a little bit of an understanding of what the different well types are.
Yeah, Senator Klayman, through the chair, John Crow, the Deputy Commissioner, here again. I'll read, if it's all right, just from the EPA website. The summary, their summaries of the classes, essentially all of them are for underground injection, so the pressurization potentially and injection of fluids. Class 1 wells are to inject hazardous and non-hazardous waste into deep isolated rock formations, so disposal wells. You may hear them described as. Class 2 wells are associated with injecting fluids associated with oil and gas production. The AOGCC has that primacy that's ongoing in Alaska. Class 3 wells are used to inject fluids to dissolve and extract minerals. So something, I don't believe we have primacy in Alaska, and I don't believe it occurs actively in Alaska, but In some places, people might inject something like to produce a brine that contains minerals, process those minerals out of the brine, re-inject it. Class 4 wells are shallow wells to inject hazardous or radioactive waste into or above geologic formations that contain drinking water. So shallow disposal of nuclear waste. That's not a well class that we have primacy for in Alaska, not associated with this legislation. Class 5 wells are a very broad class to inject non-hazardous fluids underground generally. So I would note our geothermal legislation does include the ability for AOGCC to pursue Class 5 primacy for purposes of geothermal fluid management and geothermal injection. And then Class 6 wells are for the injection of carbon dioxide.
Further follow-up?
And which of the six, which does Alaska currently have primacy for?
Senator Klayman, through the chair, we currently have Class 2 primacy, and do we have Class 1? Yeah, we Class 2 is our only primacy right now.
Thank you.
And Senator Klayman, just as a follow-up, again, this is Haley Payne for the record. I think the original text, there was some note about AOGCC having the authority to pursue Class 1, but that did not move forward, I believe, as there are it became the you must take all well classes at once sort of offer. And so Class 2 and Class 6 are unique in that the EPA will allow you to order a la carte, whereas Class 1 has kind of been lumped into you will take on all of these other ones, and our Oil and Gas Conservation Commission did not see the need for us to administer that breadth at that time.
Thank you.
Great. Further questions on slide 8? Seeing none, I'll let you proceed.
Yes, thank you. And Senator Kaufman, I'll do my best going through that to hopefully hit on some of those points for you. But this is a generalized project timeline for CCUS development. And this is really focusing in more on those early phases, everything that you do to get up to the actual investment and construction. This timeline is adopted from North Dakota. And so a lot of the months that are issued there at the bottom are based on the activities and their planned permitting timelines there. So in Alaska, that would necessarily depend, you know, have our seasonality factors and maybe a few other sort of extras that are unique to our circumstances. But essentially, when you're looking at the selection of your site, there are going to be certain checkpoints that you are going to have to go through. And that is pretty clear. And there's a lot that is very similar in terms of oil and gas development. You're going to start with your screening phase. And this is really more of a desktop exercise where you're going to use public sources of data. You may use public well data, information that you can find on core samples. There may be seismic surveys that are available for purchase. And so it starts with that sort of legacy data screening. This phase also involves kind of looking at what your particular CO2 source would be. Is there an appropriate capture technology on the market now in which you could capture that at a reasonable rate? What are the distances between that source and that sink? Because necessarily your transportation costs will add up quickly. And so a lot of this can sort of just be done as that initial screening level. And so following that, when you have an area identified, that's when you're really going to move into feasibility. And that's when you're going to start to do all of your site-specific data acquisition. And so this could be further seismic surveys. This could be drilling of stratigraphic test wells, just shallower wells to get a sense of the subsurface. Collecting core data, also beginning to set up some of your monitoring stations, because you're going to need a lot of baseline data about, you know, what are the conditions of the groundwater, what are the conditions in the atmosphere, so that you have that baseline monitoring to inform things later on as the project goes on. They have this listed at roughly about 9 to 18 months. Moving beyond this point, you'll have project design and permit application itself, and so this is where you've taken all of that site-specific information and you're starting to do your modeling. Really big in CCUS development is sophisticated different modelings that they do. And they don't just model what it's going to look like with the first injection, but sort of looking forward into what's the plume going to be at this rate in 10 years and 20 years of injection. How many years after injection ceases before that plume will stabilize? And so you're constantly getting more and more data to inform use of those models. You know, also just with anything else, you're going to start your vendor contracts, see what you can find, design your permits, and then finally submit that application for the Class 6 well permit. And that's really what's under that regulatory review of permit. And again, you see a 7 to 12 month window there. that's for North Dakota with primacy, and that could be extended longer with other states. And then finally, you have that marker of construction starting by January 1st of 2033 in order to qualify for 45Q tax credits. So you can very easily get into a four-year timeline plus just with these initial sort of exercises. And this diagram is going to appear later on in the presentation as well, and will highlight where the specific components of the bill and its authorization sort of fit along this continuum.
So a question. This is North Dakota. Yeah, we always take longer. And I would think that environmental groups would find this an appealing project. Have you seen lawsuits anywhere else objecting to this?
Yeah, Chair Giesel, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner here. You know, we have seen at a national level there's interest in carbon management, and that involves a diverse suite of groups that are supportive of and engaged in CCUS, in underground injection of carbon. That includes everybody from, obviously, oil and gas developers that have that kind of expertise, third-party companies that are offering storage as a service, environmental groups that feel it is part of carbon management in an appropriate way. There are groups that are critical of it because they feel that it's not dramatic enough of a solution, that it doesn't reduce emissions to zero immediately, or that it doesn't perform other functions in the kind of civic or social space. So there is broad support as we've assessed it, but there's also always, you know, some level of criticism. I would say litigation and challenges that we've seen to date primarily focus on the transportation of carbon dioxide over long distances, and that often involves interstate transportation. And so that's something that we don't anticipate in a near-term situation in Alaska, in the sense that whether carbon dioxide sequestration was happening on the North Slope, Cook Inlet, the interior, even in frontier areas, it would be focused on a locality, not transporting the North Slope's emissions 200 miles to a faraway place because there's a geologic destination for those emissions right there. So that is my awareness, the primary source of contention, litigation, et cetera, has been around approving transportation projects as they relate to carbon dioxide. And Deputy Director Mahan.
No, I think that was great.
All right, thank you. Senator Klayman.
In the timeline, there's none of the timeline to get the Class 6 primacy. Should that be part of our evaluation, or how does the Class 6 primacy application process fit in?
Yes, Senator Klayman, I'll venture a response and then let Haley supplement. You know, were we to look at where we're starting right now, we would need to have that primacy process on the front end. But it's not to say that someone couldn't proceed with something like screening and feasibility at the same time. As the state, as AOGCC was pursuing that primacy, they may be doing initial site characterization with existing data or data they acquire. What's kind of baked into this timeline is that you see here this file permits arrow kind of right in the center of the chart, and receive permit approvals 7 to 12 months. If we're looking at the context of states that have a super primacy, both in the Class 6 program and then more broadly, they're able to process permits quite quickly. When we have that EPA 2-year time frame, we would have to take that 7 to 12 months to 24 plus months. And so that's, as we see, the value of putting the state assuming primacy kind of at the front of this chart. Some of these activities can still go forward if a project is pursued by an industrial developer, and then we can have when we get to the permitting stage, that quicker time frame.
Follow up?
So thank you, Madam Chair. So then in theory, you'd start the primacy application at the same time as the screening, and then ideally primacy has been approved by the time the file permits are required, and if it hasn't been approved, then you're applying to EPA, which is a longer time frame, and if it has been approved, then it may be a faster time frame.
Senator Klayman, through the chair, generally, yes. You know, I'd note that this is kind of a timeline for a private sector project developer, so how they chose to proceed in the context of the state initiating that primacy effort kind of as our first step into the space would be up to them. But you can certainly imagine, given the statements by the EPA of the intent to provide primacy, the desire for it to be achieved by states, that the project developer, if the state took a proactive efforts to assume it, that they might initiate some of these efforts contemporaneously.
Good. Thank you. I think we're ready to move on.
Chair Giesel, I know we want to move quickly. I just could speak very quickly to Senator Kaufman's prior question. So, Senator Kaufman, I think you had asked about what further activities the state could be doing to promote these kind of developments and investments. You know, this administration has brought forward this legislation kind of with three components, assuming Class 6 primacy, making state lands available, and providing a regulatory structure through AFGCC, because we believe all three of those fit together and are necessary for, you know, for a project as outlined on this chart. That is not to say that there's not other things potentially the state could do. You know, in the oil and gas space and the mineral space, the state proactively assesses our resources and advertises that information. And so we could assume a very similar function here for carbon in the sense of our Division of Geological Surveys could assess existing, you know, existing wells, existing seismic data, or potentially gather new field data to not just look for hydrocarbon charged reservoirs, but look for reservoirs of any kind or containing saline aquifers or otherwise. And so I think there are opportunities, but the administration really wants to put this framework in place. So, you know, if private sector folks want to do that, they'll expend their capital. If we see market interest once we get the framework in place and we think the payoff is there, we can bring those ideas back before the legislature. But we view the pieces of the legislation as kind of integrated and necessary to support each other.
Good. Thank you. Ready to move on.
Thank you. So again, this is Haley Payne, Deputy Director. So now that we've kind of talked about those project phases, I just want to briefly look at an actual project, and maybe that'll help kind of contextualize some of these timelines a bit more. So what we're looking at here is the Redtail Energy Project, which is the first project that North Dakota approved under its Class 6 primacy. And so the Redtail Energy Project is based on an ethanol facility. Ethanol facilities are prime candidates for CCUS. They have a very high concentration CO2 just as a byproduct of the fermentation process that goes into producing ethanol. And so that's why you're seeing a lot of these first mover projects sort of being in that kind of corn belt, if you will, to being able to take advantage of that. And so this is what we consider a relatively small facility. It's only got about 180,000 metric tons per year of CO2. And so just to kind of give the committee a sense of like, well, how much space do you need to be able to inject that much CO2? And so for this particular project, the footprint of it is roughly 3,480 acres. So you can see on the image on the left there, that little green dot, that's where the actual injection well is located. Just to the northwest of that, there's a white dot, which is the monitoring well, which is sort of keeping track of the plume migration. The purple outline is where they have modeled for the entire CO2 plume to go over the life of the facility itself. And the white dotted outline is what the storage facility permit actually enabled them to use. And one more note on there, there's a black outline that's even broader out below that, about a mile outside of that. And that's what's called the area of review. Whenever you're trying to get a Class 6 permit, it's going to be that area that extends beyond those buffers is where they're going to want to understand what are all the considerations in terms of ensuring the protection of the reservoir and whether or not there's other mineral interest owners there. And I just like that picture on the right because I think that could be the North Slope anywhere, but that's just North Dakota and the actual drilling of the exploration well.
No questions.
Okay. So then maybe to Senator Klayman's question there a little bit earlier. So North Dakota applied for primacy in 2013. And this particular project had a five-year evaluation to go from the site screening all the way through design. It took them 5 years. And so that site screening project actually started in 2016. And so you can see that North Dakota had already started its primacy process, and that kind of sent that signal to industry that we're moving forward with this and sort of enabled those investment decisions to spend that money to drill those wells, to conduct that seismic, and to collect those cores. And so I think just having that idea of does one have to happen before the other, I'd say there are activities that can be ongoing during the pendency of the primacy application. North Dakota did receive their primacy authority, in 2018. And this facility was ultimately permitted in 2021. And just this last year in June is when it started commercial operation and actual injection opportunities. The image on the left is similar just in terms of those phases, but it really also sort of brings up that in some cases it's linear, but in other cases it has more of an adaptive management framework. You're always going to get more data, you're going to do more modeling, and you're going to continue to refine that over time. So it's more of a feedback loop than necessarily a point A to point B sort of project.
No questions. I'll let you move on.
And so on this slide, we're really going to turn now to actually looking at the legislation. This is going to be just an overview, and in the subsequent sessions, we'll dig a little bit more deeper. But so here we take those project phases, and we show the different sections of the bill in which we're addressing those. And so we see everything through the exploration phase into the well and facility permitting. We added an extra phase of leasing just to capture our own project a little bit better, storage operations and facility closure. And as you'll see, the real primary sections of this bill are in sections 14 and 31. But the big takeaway is that this legislation has tried to think of the comprehensive look of these projects and what is everything an investor going to need to know in terms of from the beginning of exploration all the way through to site closure.
Great. I don't see any questions. I love the slide.
So on this slide, we're going to look at the four kind of major project authorizations that are included in this legislation. This is by no means meant to be an exhaustive list of everything that it takes to do one of these projects, but just to kind of put along those continuum, what are the sort of the four big factors that we're going to be putting in as a part of this legislation? And so the first one here on the left is going to be one that it would be issued by DNR. And so this is a carbon storage exploration license. And so what this does is this grants the exclusive right to explore an area for carbon storage site. And now when I say exclusive right to explore, that doesn't mean that that's the only use for that land. Other folks are welcome to explore that land for, you know, their oil and gas. Other folks could be using it for recreation. So it's not prohibited to other uses. It's just for carbon storage, it gives them that first right of the exploration for it. This is very similar to our oil and gas exploration license program, insofar as you typically start with a larger area, and then as you conduct activities, you'll necessarily narrow in more specifically on where that project would be most likely to go. The exploration license is set up with a 5-year term. That's your 5-year primary term. And associated with that, you have a work commitment and annual rental requirements. This exploration license can then be converted into a lease based upon actually completing those work commitments and progressing along to a carbon storage permit, as we'll talk about in the next section. We really wanted to keep an eye on the fact that we wanted to make sure our lands were progressing continuously along this continuum and that it wasn't just for the purposes of warehousing. In order to have this 5-year term, you can't just sit and have it. You actually have to meet certain stop gates. And if you want to take it into that post 5-year period, you must actually move forward with the storage facility permit itself.
Before you go on, Deputy Director, for Senator Dunbar, who's online, we're on slide 13. And it would be helpful if we mentioned that each time we change slides. Thanks.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair. And so the last bullet on that particular window there is that this does not authorize specific activities. So folks would actually still have to go through and get their, you know, seismic licensing authorities. You may have your fish and wildlife habitat permits. So there's still surface permits that are necessary. This is just more the right to explore that subsurface for these purposes.
Question, Senator Welikowski.
Thank you. Are you, I assume that the wells that will be used to store the carbon are wells whose leases have expired so that the state wouldn't be in a position where we would have to buy back leases. Is that correct?
Senator Welikowski, through the chair, no, there isn't any anticipation of buying back leases. And so this is more set up, and as we'll get to in other provisions, there's opportunities for an existing lessee who's doing enhanced oil recovery with carbon to then transition that just to carbon sequestration. And there's also opportunities for an existing oil and gas lessee to obtain a carbon storage exploration license. But there's nothing that about carbon storage that condemns or ends up an existing property right or lease.
Is the expectation that these will be privately run, privately managed carbon storage sites, and that the state will lease out the rights to these areas and then collect a small fee, or what's the expectation?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, yes, I think that summarizes it perfectly. The state is acting in its position through DNR as the landowner. And so just as any landowner would, allowing, you know, private industry to come in and the use of that land for the payment of the fee. Now AOGCC would be acting as regulator on that project, ensuring that those subsurface protections are taking place. But this is not for the state to actually conduct the injection activities itself.
Follow up.
And so what's your expectation about how much the state will get? Is it, I saw the number $2.50 versus how much the owner-operator or the operator, the lessee, will get?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, just to understand, are you asking about the overall revenue of a CCUS project?
Right. Yeah, my understanding is there's $85 in 45Q tax credits available.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious how much of that's going to go to the state and how much of that is expected to go to the organization or the person, the company that leases out this area. What's the breakdown? Is the state going to get? I saw a number reference to $2.50 somewhere. Is the state getting $2.50 and the other company getting the $82.50 or what's the expectation?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair again. So just to be clear, that $2.50 that you've seen in there, that's a minimum number. So that's not actually stating what it would be. We're just providing some floors. There would actually be sort of a negotiation process as a part of the exploration license, where we say what that fee would be based on the expectation of the size of that area. Now, in terms of does the operator get the other $82.50, I think it's fair to say that there are other costs that sort of go into that $82.50 along the way. There's the cost of capture. For instance, is it, you know, $25 a ton to capture that carbon? Is it another $10 per ton to transport that carbon? Is it another further $5 per ton to operate the injection facility itself? And so over time, that $85 a ton gets sort of whittled down to the, whatever those profit margins would be. And the intention is not to limit ourselves to a per ton injection fee. There are a number of different models that exist out there. There's per ton injection fees. There's share of the 45Q tax credits. There's bonus bids. There's gross revenues. There's a lot of different ways to imagine your revenue potential, and those are continuing to evolve along with this industry.
Just one last question, Madam Chair. Is the expectation if an oil and gas company has a well that they want to lease out and they want to develop this, will they be able to write that off their taxes, their oil production taxes, for example, or their corporate income taxes?
So, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, you know, I think John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner of DNR here, I think we'd probably want the Department of Revenue to speak to this particularly, but it's our understanding that the oil and gas production tax under existing law allowable lease expenditures are for the production of oil and gas. And so that can include, in some circumstances, projects that are for enhanced oil recovery, but it cannot, by its terms, include projects that are for carbon sequestration. That's a different function than the production of oil and gas. And so it is certainly the case that there is these 45Q credits, there are some oil and gas EOR operations that could be eligible for them. And so there could be some interplay between the production tax, EOR, and the 45Q, but a significant amount of projects, including all projects that are focused solely on storage and sequestration, allowable lease expenditures under the oil and gas production tax would not be assessed against them.
We can certainly have Department of Revenue come before us. Thank you, Senator Wilikowski. Further questions? I'll let you proceed then, Deputy Director.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, this is Haley Payne, Deputy Director. So I'm still here on slide 13. So for the carbon storage facility permit, this is the authorization that would be issued by the AOGCC. And this is really what takes account the approval of that subsurface storage container. So that would be irrespective of that state of Alaska lands or also private lands as well that could be involved in this. The point of this is to bring together all the different pore space based on the geologic and engineering data. As we know, our containers don't always follow our boundaries along our lease lines. And so this is what contemplates for that. As a part of this, if AOGCC did have Class 6 well primacy, that Class 6 well authorization would be a component of this carbon storage facility permit. However, this carbon storage facility permit is still necessary even if AOGCC did not have Class 6 well primacy, because the AOGCC would still have the authority on bringing together the different pore space and determining the protection of the subsurface for the state of Alaska and prevention of waste. Within this permit, we also provide for protection of other mineral interest owners and property interests. It establishes the monitoring and bonding requirements, and it guides operations over the life of the project. And then moving forward, I know there's a lot on this slide, I promise it'll get a little easier. So after this, we have our carbon storage lease. And so if you're the explorer, you've gotten your exploration license from DNR, you've assessed your area, you've done your modeling, you've determined this is the location that I need for my storage facility permit, you go to the AOGCC. And once the AOGCC approves that storage facility permit, then you're allowed to convert that license into a lease. And so that's usually going to be a smaller subset. We're going to have that refined area down. And that carbon storage lease will authorize the exclusive use of that reservoir for the duration of the project life. That's going to include terms for revenue to the state. And also, one of these would be required if a reservoir is going to transition from enhanced oil recovery activities to one that is just carbon sequestration. And then finally, one of the other major authorizations of this bill is going to be a closure certificate. And so what this one does is an operator may apply at least 10 years post-injection. So as it's designed now, after you're done injecting, the EPA has a default monitoring period of about 50 years. And that in that default monitoring period, that's when you're supposed to determine whether or not the plume has stabilized, if it's done traveling, if it's going to stay within its bounds and confines. And so that period could take as low as 10 years or it could take more. But basically, once that plume is completely stabilized and when you'd be essentially off the hook from your Class 6 well requirements as it is, the state can step in after public notice and hearing and take title to that CO2 and to that reservoir to sort of maintain that sort of long-term monitoring and maintenance of that site. This would be funded, as something we'll get into in the next section, by the Carbon Storage Trust Fund over the life of the project. So it is AOGCC that would issue this. It would be in consultation and coordination with DER, DNR, and DEC. But then ultimately, the state DNR would help manage that over the post-injection period.
I see no questions. I'll let you go on to slide 14.
So on slide 14, this is more just a note that throughout the injection lifetimes, there's ongoing oversight. And so just to give the committee a sense of what that looks like, that's on-site inspection program, well work, drilling permits, a lot of monthly reporting, pressure surveys, well logs. So these are all the different mechanisms that are in place to be able to track like where the CO2 actually is and is it behaving as modeled, and if not, what changes need to be made to the model in order to more accurately cover that. And as you can see, there's the use of monitoring wells, there's remote equipment, and then there's also sort of surface sampling of groundwaters as well that would take place.
All right. Thank you. You can proceed.
Okay, so we're going to skip slide 15 as it's just a header, and we're here on slide 16 for funding sources. So back to that original discussion about sort of the two buckets or two pools, if it were. So the AOGCC would be managing the regulatory program. And so similar to how they're designed now, where they have a regulatory cost charge, which essentially covers the cost of AOGCC and all the activities they do to oversee a program in a given year, this has a similar function. It's going to be called the Carbon Dioxide Storage Facility Administrative Fund. And so this is covered by all of the fees associated with the regulatory portion of this. This can include fees assessed to review the actual permit. This can include fees that are a per ton injection fee that's kind of charged on top of everything else to ensure that AOGCC is sort of covered as whole for its use for the year. And also fees for determining storage amounts. The monitoring, reporting, and verification is a very important component of CCUS. And so determining what amount of CO2 has been stored is also a part of that, and the AOGCC would be able to collect fees for that as well. So it's anticipated that once the projects are up and running, that the program itself would be covered from a regulatory perspective just based on the operator's expenses to this fund. on the other side, the other piece of the puzzle, you have where DNR would be in the leasing and licensing of state lands. And this is where you get into the revenues that would accrue. And so as Senator Wilikowski pointed out, we do have some minimums included in there, a minimum rental rate of $20 per acre, minimum injection charge of $2.50 per ton of CO2, and there is the opportunity for other commercial terms. Also included in this is going to just be the note that those funds, just like any mineral interest funds, are going to be distributed according to the general fund and the permanent fund. So those are sort of the two buckets that we have, the sovereign and the regulator.
Senator Wilikowski, question?
Yeah, two questions. Number one, where'd you come up with the rates, $20 and $2.50? Is that sort of industry standard? And number two, is are you viewing that there to be a legal requirement to deposit a percentage into the permanent fund?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, to your first question, so we did conduct a survey of other sort of public sources of data for the licensing terms, and these are certainly like the floor that we have seen. Some folks do like a 4% of 45Q tax credits, and when you did the math out, it equated to roughly $2.50 per ton of carbon dioxide injected. And so we've seen some that are on the lower end. We've also seen some that are higher up than this. But it also really depends on the maturity of the program itself. And so some of those places that are more kind of on the frontier or just starting or trying to draw that attention have put in some lower rates. And some folks that are, you know, are now on their fourth or fifth contract are beginning to up those and escalate those fees as they've understood more of the value. And again, these are just minimums. I think that we would certainly not always seek to go with a minimum. But this is just to kind of put a floor in there, just like we have for our oil and gas regime. And I believe
So thank you, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, John Crow, the deputy commissioner here. Your second question on the mineral nature, this in part derives from, you know, we understand the pore space to be a mineral resource. Mineral resources are obligated to be deposited into the permanent fund. There's also been a Supreme Court case that has identified SINGSA under the related to the SINGSA storage facility for natural gas that identified mineral pore space used for storage as a mineral resource. And so we believe that, you know, while not necessarily inherently controlling vis-a-vis how all pore space in Alaska is administered, that court case, along with the our understanding of it, does trigger that requirement for these mineral revenues to be dedicated to the fund.
I don't see any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you. So again, this is Haley Payne. We are now on slide 17, looking at the Closure Trust Fund. And so as referenced before, in for the post-closure period, the state could set up a carbon storage closure trust fund. This is an industry-funded and state-administered trust fund to be used solely for the long-term monitoring of the site during the post-closure period. The income revenue sources for this are a per-ton injection charge. This would not be deducted from that $20 an acre, say. There would be an additional charge as well. And it's based on the anticipated expenses to be incurred in the post-closure phases. What's interesting to note is that as a part of your Class 6 well permit, you are required to do a post-injection site closure plan, and you have to update those at least every 5 years. And so they're continuously updated based on, you know, more information about the plume, more information about the industry, more information about, you know, what those costs may be, what the technologies that are available in terms of remote monitoring, et cetera. And so you have the ability to adjust and reflect those in line with the different post-injection site closure plans as they come. The state may utilize those funds directly or use them as other markets mature and perhaps purchase sort of other things like an insurance policy, which I think some folks have spoke to the committee before about those different insurance markets which are developing now.
Questions on this slide? Seeing none.
Thank you. So moving on to slide 18, these are hypothetical revenue opportunities. And so what we tried to do here was just sort of imagine a few different scenarios. And again, these are not based on actual projects or project commitments. This is really just taking those sort of minimum numbers that are included in the bill at this point in time. And what are some reasonable amounts of CO2 and what are reasonable life cycles of a project to be? And so For the first hypothetical revenue scenario, we're imagining a regional power facility that has about 250,000 metric tons per year of CO2. This is on par with some of our own power generating facilities in the state, namely some of the interior coal plants, as well as some of the gas powered stations in the Anchorage area. So we imagine that in order to inject that much CO2, you need roughly 1,200 acres. And so that's sort of where we're deriving these at $20 per acre. The next scenario is a North Slope emitting facility. And so in this one, we imagine there's about 2 million metric tons. So this is more like a medium-sized project. We're kind of building up a little bit bigger here. For this one, this isn't based on any particular project, again. But we're saying if you have that CO2 of 2 million metric tons per year, what would it look like if 1 million tons of those were injected for storage and the other 1 million tons were used for enhanced oil recovery? Because CO2 is a very good product for that. And so, again, a 20-year life cycle, and this would take roughly about 10,000 acres in order to store that sort of volume of CO2. And then last, we have what would be a large carbon sequestration project. And so this is like an import scenario where you'd be bringing in 10 million metric tons per year. And so this has a longer life cycle over it and would necessarily take a larger acreage position, about 50,000 acres per ton for injection.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Giesel, John Crow, the Deputy Commissioner. If I can just supplement here, one thing that's not addressed on the slide, as my colleague Haley has mentioned, is that these are hypothetical projects, so we're not trying to forecast cost or commercial decisions. What they call the cost of capture, the ability to achieve a concentrated CO2 stream, is a major cost driver for these projects. And so could, you know, people are attempting to capture carbon dioxide emissions from coal flue stacks with success right now, capturing carbon dioxide from natural gas emissions from when it's burned and consumed is more challenging because it's more diffuse in the fuel. And so those costs of capture are not modeled or not included. We just really wanted to look at if this project occurs, these are the kinds of revenue under the legislation we could see.
Senator Clayman, question?
On that specific area, is the essential model we're looking at that a third party would basically come up with a economically satisfactory model to capture the carbon, and they would bring that CO2 up to us and pay us for what we have to be able to store it after they transport it up to where we are? This is specifically on the third example. I recognize the North Slope is a little different. But.
Yeah, so Senator Clayman, through the chair, I think it is there's a couple different ways. You know, this third category, essentially the import of CO2 and the storage from CO2 potentially coming from all over the world, we could see that provided entirely by a third party. So they're managing shipping, they're managing the commercial development of a project to pressurize and inject, they're managing all the permitting of the injection. It's theoretical at some point down the line, the state could make a policy decision that says some portion of that kind of industrial activity we want to participate in through, you know, that's a very theoretical at this stage, but as we've conceived right in this example, it would have a third party that essentially runs the entire project and is paying the state for the right to use the land and then the injection fee in the land.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sounds like, of course, depending on where they get the source of the captured carbon, that the transportation, the cost of transportation is going to be a big question mark about. Does it make sense to move the carbon from wherever it is captured up to a location in Alaska where it can be stored? Have you identified a place where somebody at this point where somebody's going to capture the carbon and bring here?
Yes, Senator Clayman, through the chair, I think you're right that in this kind of scenario, a major cost of a project like this would be the transportation of the CO2 in addition to the capture wherever it originates from. I believe one of the presenters earlier this week talked about that there was active work. There's existing barging of CO2, barging on rivers today. There's projects underway that involve the shipment, short distance, but ocean-going shipment. And then there's people looking at what the cost structure, what the technologies, et cetera, are to do open ocean, you know, transatlantic, transpacific carbon shipping. So I think it costs, that effort, as I would understand it, is essentially to understand the cost and to drive that cost down, but it would be a significant one in Project 3. Sorry for such a long answer.
Thank you.
Further questions on this slide? Seeing none.
Thank you. Turning now to slide 19, just a few of those caveats I think were already explained here. So for these revenue opportunities, at this time, not all CO2 emissions are feasibly captured. This technology continues to rapidly develop. So to Senator Klayman's point about, where is our ship transfer at and how is that cost? So again, these scenarios don't look into that. They look into, assuming all of that works, where is the state, what would be the revenues that we can bring in? Timing from bill passage, I think, is always a question. How long can we anticipate before some of this? And so, again, in a kind of just a 10,000 foot view, if a project was already through its screening phase, let's say they, used AOGCC's wonderful online database, they've already determined, hey, we know where there's a source, we have an appropriate thing of technology that we can use to capture that carbon. Licensing revenues, which is just for that exploration phase, we may be able to see in as soon as 2 years, from the time of bill passage. And again, that's assuming the project's kind of ready to go. What would happen in that interim 2 years would be the regulatory promulgation of the regulations from DNR, as well as receiving an application and then writing a best interest finding to determine whether or not that license is in the best interest of the state. So that's sort of baked into that licensing revenue timing consideration. Leasing revenues, I think that dates us back to our previous sort of continuum, that timeline of how long it takes to get a project off the ground. So these are, if everything was ready, as soon as the bill is sort of ready to go, this is kind of when we may see some revenues.
And Deputy Director, you said that the project had to start by 2032?
Chair Geisler, yes. So they have to have construction started by the end of 2032.
So this is a 7-year project, and we're in 23 now. So sooner is better in regards to passing this policy.
Yes, Madam Chair, that would be sort of the urgency behind our request here today. So thank you.
All right, thank you. Any other questions on this slide? Seeing none.
Now we're on to slide 20. A lot of information here, but basically just taking those hypothetical revenue opportunities and looking like what they would bring in for the use of the state's pore space over the lifetime of the project. Again, these are undiscounted numbers. This is just pretty straight exercise with that $250 per ton and $20 per acre. And you can see the figures here on the screen of what could be realized over the life of that. We have anything from $11 million over 2 years to quite a bit higher when you're looking at that large-scale CO2 importation. And again, just the sort of best-case hypothetical scenarios. But I think it's a fair representation of what a small CCUS project could bring over its life and what a large-scale project could bring over its life.
And Deputy Director, this doesn't include things like the insurance cost. Is that something the state would incur, or is that something that the producer would be responsible for?
Yeah, Chair Geisel, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner here. So this chart focuses on the, as in the current legislation, the acreage rental fee and the injection fee. There's also a requirement for an operator under this project, which is not depicted in this table, to pay that fee into the administrative fund. And that would accumulate over time for the long-term liability of the state. An operator might choose to purchase different kinds of insurance in the course of their operations, vis-a-vis their receipt of the 45Q credits, their general, revenues, et cetera. But that we view during a facility operation that the state wouldn't have a need to participate in those insurance markets, but an operator might very well.
Gotcha, thank you. Mm-hmm. Further questions on this side? Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, I believe to Mr. Crowther, in the slope example, the carbon source would just be locally produced carbon, so there's no anticipation of shipping carbon to the slope.
Senator Kaufman, through the chair, that's correct. The 2 million tons per year example cited is roughly the size of the emissions associated with, I believe, the central gas processing facility, some of the large ongoing operations. And so that's just kind of a proxy for if existing operations, all of that carbon was captured, which, as we pointed out earlier, the cost of capture for a project like that might be quite high.
All right. I don't see any other questions on this slide.
So moving forward, we'll get into our sectional summary here.
And Deputy Director, just in terms of time, we actually have allotted time on Monday if we don't finish the sectional today, because there could be significant questions about the actual words. So we have allotted time on Monday as well. Don't feel rushed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try not to speed read too much then.
Okay.
Recognizing it's Friday afternoon. So thank you. So here we're going to get into the actual sectional summary of the bill. As indicated before, there are quite a few elements of this which are just more conforming amendments or things we can note. But we will go into greater detail on sections 14 and on sections 31. So for section 1, that's just the short title of the bill, the Carbon Capture Utilization Storage Act. Section 2 is going to grant AO's GOCC the jurisdiction to regulate carbon storage unit operations, just as it does for oil and gas units presently. In Section 3, we find that authority to seek the Class 6 well primacy. Section 4 is actually what creates that carbon storage closure trust fund that we've discussed for that post-closure operations of state agencies. And in Section 5, that adds carbon storage to the mineral estate disposal exemption for agricultural lands. Again, this is just consistent with oil and gas. And Section 6 adds carbon storage exemptions for when state lands are leased for purposes other than for extraction of natural resources. Section 7 adds carbon storage provisions to pay damages to landowners and to post bonds for that purposes. So this is, again, where we're getting that split estate situation where the surface owner and the subsurface owner are different, and there's the ability to enter the land in order to develop the mineral estate, or in this case, to inject into it. It's required, obviously, that landowner be worked with, compensated. If those agreements are unable to be met, then DNR would step in and require the posting of bonds and do other calculations to ensure that landowner is made whole for any damages to their property.
Senator Wilkowski, question.
That language in Section 7, it says rights may not be exercised, et cetera, until the state, its lessees, successors, or assigns make provision to pay the owner of the land full payment for all damages sustained by the owner by reason of entering upon the land. What kind of liability are we exposing the state to here potentially? What's like worst case scenario? And is the state expecting to purchase insurance for damages?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, what I can say is that this provision has been in place for all of our oil and gas, for our mining, and for our geothermal programs. And in terms of oil and gas, we have yet to use it yet. So this isn't exactly something that comes up frequently. We often find that the surface owners and the project operators come to a mutually beneficial situation. This isn't necessarily something we see happen, but this is just to provide the provisions for that sort of protection. In terms of this, you know, when you're imagining accessing the surface of the land, the footprint, the surface footprint of a carbon storage facility is very small. I mean, you're talking like, in one case, I think the Red Tail Energy one I've heard, literally looks just like a white shed, like on the side of the road. And so you're not exactly talking about an extensive location for the ability to enter that land. And as we'll see later on in some of the other materials for AOGCC, there's different discussions about how to compensate mineral owners and ensure that any protections are in place there as well. But this is just for the surface estate, for that sort of split estate scenario, to ensure that those protections are there.
Any other questions on that section? All right, section 8.
Okay, still continuing on here on slide 22. So sections 8 through 11 add the carbon storage program to the mineral leasing statutes, specifically for how we collect revenues, just noting that when it's due, and that there's interest if there's a late payment and interest on overpayment. So again, this is very standard with our oil and gas. Section 12 adds carbon storage provisions to the exemptions for coal bed methane and unconventional gas, because carbon storage leasing may still be possible on unminable coal seams. And so this is just sort of addressing that nexus between our coal mining land and then our ability to use coal for other purposes like gas purposes, or in this case, also for carbon storage.
All right, no questions on that section?
And then Section 13 adds carbon storage leases to the prohibition in the Ketchikan Bay area. Again, we're just trying to stay as consistent with oil and gas activities as possible. There's no specific reason to do that exemption except to maintain that consistency through statute with how we treat oil and gas.
Question, Senator Wilikowski.
Are there other areas that are, so it's basically Ketchikan Bay, you're excluding controversial area. Are there other refuges or areas that prohibit oil and gas exploration or development that are not being, that are being allowed to be leased out?
Senator Wilikowski through the chair and Deputy Commissioner Crowther can supplement. No, we're not doing anything different with carbon storage leasing than we will have with oil and gas. I believe later on in the last sections of the bill, there's a couple other areas that are noted in terms of excluded similar to oil and gas or permissible just as oil and gases. So again, we're just trying to mirror it because it's such a similar process and are not doing anything that allows it in one area where it's not allowed in another.
Follow up?
And I know years ago there was a lot of property owners who were concerned about was it coal bed methane up in the valley going under private property owners. Are we envisioning that sort of scenario where carbon would be stored under private property owners' properties, creating a concern among property owners?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, there are portions of the bill later on that speak to the AOGCC authority to amalgamate property interests from essentially unconsenting parties, similar to authorities we have for oil and gas. In the event, you know, whether it's a primarily a state land or in a rare case, it's potentially a dozen private landowners, 11 want to participate in the project, one doesn't. How to acknowledge and manage the potential reservation of revenues, the rights of that non-consenting owner in the course of the project proceeding, because it may migrate under their land. So there's a recognition of that potential.
And I'm just curious what sort of damage could a person suffer? Let's say somebody's got a house. What sort of, could there be a collapse of land, seismic issue? I mean, what sort of issues are? I just want to understand the ramifications of what we're getting into by going under an unconsenting landowner's property.
Yeah, Senator Wilikowski through the chair. I think, you know, I'm not a geologist and nor an engineer, but I think as we've conceived it, these situations frequently speak to a property owner who doesn't conceptually want to participate, and that the damages are thus financial, in the sense that they decline to participate. If the project thus could not proceed, an economic activity could occur. If a project does proceed, they should be compensated despite the fact that they didn't assent. The scenarios that you described, I think, are very natural questions. You know, are there issues of surface subsidence associated with underground injection? You know, and we can have Dr. LePain speak in more detail to that. These injection horizons are quite deep underground, akin to the production of existing oil and gas. The geologic structures that make them secure for containing oil and gas or containing carbon dioxide also generally make them secure from affecting, you know, surface properties as we understand it in a way that would affect a landowner at their surface enjoyment of their rights. And, you know, similarly, induced seismicity, something that has been observed in the sense of fracture operations where developers are attempting to fracture rocks by overpressuring them to create ability for fluids to migrate, oil and gas to migrate. That kind of activity is specifically avoided and conditioned against in these permits because you do not want to fracture these reservoirs because you want to allow the CO2 to propagate throughout them. And so you know, were a operator to be operating a facility in such a manner to induce fractures in the reservoir, I can't speak as DNR, but under the legislation, that would be inconsistent with the requirements that they would have to commit to AOGCC.
Follow up, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. And what about above ground concerns? What about somebody who doesn't want pipelines going across their land, somebody who doesn't want, I mean, could you put a drill rig on somebody's land and say, well, sorry, you don't want it, but it's we own the subsurface rights, we're going to put a drill rig on your land and go ahead and store carbon.
Yes. So, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I believe Section 7 somewhat speaks to that issue. You know, the mineral estate is dominant in Alaska, and so the mineral estate owner, and oftentimes the state, has the right to exercise or lease for the exercise of those rights, and that can affect a surface owner, and it can, in theory, occur when a surface owner does not want that surface use to occur. Under the statute for oil and gas and under the statute here, that operator would be liable for damages incurred by that use. They would not be prohibited necessarily from doing it, but they would be liable for the damages to do it. If they were seeking that kind of activity, they might have to proactively post a bond to prepare for that situation. And I think that, you know, as we've seen in the oil and gas world, including on, you know, Cook Inlet, where there is private ownership and in some cases private minerals, so there can be these landowner disputes, there is significant incentive for an operator to avoid a situation where they're incurring even the possibility of those damages because they are liable for them. And so finding a consenting surface owner or a consenting surface location is much more favorable to avoid that issue. But I don't want to represent that a surface activity could never occur on someone's property that was overlaying a mineral estate that the state had leased.
Any other questions on that section? We're down to 2 minutes, and this might be a good place to stop since you said content is significant in Section 14. So we could pick that up on Monday. So any closing questions from committee members? All right. Thank you very much for being here today and going through this with us, and we'll look forward to seeing you on Monday afternoon. We do have a couple bills up, but we have allocated a good 45 minutes to an hour for completion of this. So thank you. So at this time, we'll conclude our meeting. The next meeting is Monday, March 13th at 3:30 p.m. On the agenda, we have a first hearing of HDR 5, Alaska Fisheries, Troll Fisheries. We have Senate Bill 67, PFAS use for firefighting, and Senate Bill 49. This bill. So at this time, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 4:59 p.m.